The following program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. It's the North Carolina Reading Service bringing you Indie Week, and it's read today by John Federson. The current issue now, Wednesday, July 21 of 2021. And our sparkling theme music is today furnished by BoilerplateThemes.com. Their motto is borrowed talent at its best. And the is actually part of their motto. So we'll hear again from them at the close of the broadcast. BoilerplateThemes.com. And Indie Week, as we may remember from last week's issue, just put out their Best of the Triangle Award series with hundreds of listings for the Triangle at large, some of which I believe I read, I had time to read last week, and some of which are by locale. And if we run out of articles, I will just move in and just outline a few more of those. They make good broadcast filler. And some people pay lots of attention to them, particularly the business owners that get these awards. So let's get started now with a first 15 minutes column, which I rarely play because of time considerations. But this spotlights a fellow named Charles Chavez Adams, 29. He was a Raleigh lawyer. Sarah Pequeño wrote this, mentioning that Mr. Adams was in a life-or-death situation last year after contracting COVID-19. At the ER, the doctor realized he was experiencing myocarditis and used a new type of heart pump to give his heart a rest, saving his life in the process. So this question and answer, tell me about when you first started experiencing symptoms. He answers, my wife and I were hanging out with a friend. After the weekend was over, we found out that we got COVID from her. We quarantined for 14 days after she told us she had tested positive. These 14 days were rough for me personally. I had a lot of different symptoms, a severe headache, lost my appetite. My wife, on the other hand, was pretty fine, so she was taking care of me. A month later, I was on a hike with my dog. We usually go on a hike every day. That morning was different because I wasn't able to complete the hike. I got maybe 5 minutes in, and I had to call my wife to let her know I couldn't complete my walk. And we ended up going back to the apartment. I was feeling really bad, very tired. I don't know what was wrong with me. We went to urgent care, did a COVID test. My temperature was 105.4. They sent me to the ER. I got a whole lot of different tests. They came back with nothing. They couldn't find out what was wrong with me, so they gave me some Tylenol. They told me to take it to get my temperature down, and we went back home. As time progressed, I got worse. Temperature kept going back to 104, 105. We went to another urgent care. The doctor basically told us they couldn't find anything wrong with me. Gave me a bunch of tests. Nothing came up positive, so they sent us home with some Motrin and told us to wait it out. As time progressed, it got worse, and we were trying to figure out what to do. I ended up passing out. My wife was alarmed, so we went to another ER and got some answers. We went to the fourth ER, and we found out that I had pneumonia in my chest. Question, how long were you at the Wake Med COVID unit? It was less than a day. I went that morning, and one of the doctors in charge of admitting to a special unit was present while I was there. He was in my chart and told me I needed to be transferred. And I was transferred to a new unit, and that's when they started having conversations about the Impella heart pump, which was used to get my heart a rest and basically saved my life. What was the process of recovery like? That 1 month window, I didn't know I was sick, but having the heart pump, I felt like I had more energy. That was a relief. I had more energy. I was breathing regularly again, and I just felt overall more healthy and better. I'm grateful that we had an amazing team, amazing cardiologists, nurses, super excited that we had the Impella heart pump. I'm grateful for all the prayers and the thoughts from our friends and family. On to news, now from Raleigh and Lee Tausch's column, Development Unarrested. A myth that the council banned single-family zoning is circulating in Raleigh. It didn't. But a new text change will allow missing middle housing throughout the city. On July 6th, the Raleigh City Council voted to update the city's zoning code to allow the development of denser housing options, such as duplexes and apartments, where previously only single-family housing was allowed. The majority of council members say the change will encourage this much-needed missing middle housing, multi-unit, house-scale buildings in low-rise residential neighborhood, and promote affordability in neighborhoods with few housing options. Councilmember David Cox, the sole dissenting vote against the change, disagreed. That night in a blog post to community activist group Livable Raleigh, Cox vented his frustrations, characterizing the change as, quote, the elimination of single-family zoning. He called the ordinance a Trojan horse that would, quote, guarantee the sprawl of high-priced density that will lead to more traffic congestion, gentrification, evictions, and the loss of existing affordability. But the myth that the text change effectively bans single-family zoning is just that, a myth. Ken Bowers, Raleigh City Planner, says the word ban implies that something is prohibited. Single-family housing is permitted everywhere and always has been. Has the city banned retail zoning because the districts that permit retail also permit other things? What the ordinance does, Bowers explained, is simply extend the options available in the majority of the city's residential zones. Previously, you could build only attached housing types, duplex, townhouse, or apartment, in two residential zones. Now, only one district, R1, permits single-family to the exclusion of other housing types, and Bauer says that zone is very limited and surrounds watersheds with stricter development policies. The update will go into effect on August the 3rd. Bowers says his department plans to track the impact over the next year and report back to the council. He says, this is definitely a change. The ordinance is changing the way the city is approaching single-family zoning, but it's an evolution, and it remains to be seen exactly what the market response is to this. The intent was incremental change over time. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin says the change will allow housing options throughout the city, mirroring many of Raleigh's older neighborhoods, which were built before zoning laws became more restrictive. There, you can see duplexes and modest apartments alongside single-family homes. Baldwin says opening the door to denser housing could also be the gateway to home ownership for many who can't afford traditional single-family homes. Quote, before we approved this ordinance, you could not build a townhouse in 80% of that city. And that's usually someone's entry into home ownership. Not everybody can afford a single-family home, but certainly we can reduce the cost of housing through townhomes, duplexes, whatnot. I want to be able to create those choices. For Councilmember Nicole Stewart, who voted in favor of the ordinance, the move is just one of many things the council is doing to expand housing options and promote affordability throughout the city, including allowing accessory dwelling units by right and the passage of the affordable housing bond. She characterized opposition to the charge as, quote, fear of the unknown. Bucking change, however, won't combat the city's burgeoning affordability crisis, Stewart told the Indy. If we keep things the way we have them, then the only people it stays affordable for are those who have them now. So things have to change. If we want sustainable and affordable housing, then we have to do things to get more of that. Keeping it the way it is isn't going to solve anything. During public comments on the change, former city council member Steph Mendel, one of the main figureheads behind Livable Raleigh, along with fellow ousted council member Russ Stevenson, was the first to speak against the change. Mendel says, I just want to say one thing. Density does not equal affordable. David Knight, who beat Mendel in the 2019 District E race, says the change, with other initiatives the council has pursued, could create more affordable housing. Quote, What we're trying to do is create more affordable housing opportunities in more parts of the city. Denser housing can be more affordable housing. It not always will be, but it can be, and it goes along with the greater policies of trying to reduce sprawl as much as possible. Livable Raleigh is also intended in an effort, it's also involved in an effort to recall Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin over concerns about the council meeting behind closed doors to discuss pushing back the election to 2022 due to pandemic-driven census delays. The legislature ultimately approved the council's request, but the bill earned a rebuke from Governor Roy Cooper, who didn't sign it into law. Cox says he has no statement regarding the recall effort. Stewart noted that recall attempts have happened to other Raleigh mayors, including Nancy McFarlane and Charles Meeker. Stewart says, I don't think this is anything new and exciting. I think this is just what happens when you have a democracy that's working. Folks are allowed to express their opinions. Baldwin, who recalled the failed recall attempt against Meeker, which happened when she was first elected to the council a decade ago, says, I'm taking all of this in stride. Last week, we were named the number two best place to live in the country, Baldwin told the Indy. Obviously, we're doing something right. Our next story, news from North Carolina, originally published in NC Health News, written by Elizabeth Thompson. Point of return. When Jeff Walker came out of incarceration, all he had were the clothes on his back. He was directionless, stigmatized. He didn't have support. He didn't have anything. That was 5 years ago. People leaving jails and prisons and reentering society during the pandemic face the same stigma, the same lack of direction, all while attempting to navigate a global pandemic. For those leaving prison, vital in-person connection is hard to come by, even in regular times. Finding a job has proven more difficult due to the pandemic-generated lag times for identification and Social Security cards, not to mention broadband disparities that make Wi-Fi moot in some rural areas. Walker gets those struggles. After reentering society but still experiencing substance use issues, he was able to find solace in transitional housing and the connections he made there 5 years ago. Now, he works to give other formerly incarcerated people another chance as a program manager for Wilkes Recovery Revolution in North Wilkesboro and a member of the Peer Justice Initiative, a group of formerly incarcerated people who advocate for others re-entering society and within the jail and prison systems. Personal connections are critical for those returning to society after a period of incarceration. Peer-to-peer support is what Walker and others in the Peer Justice Initiative are all about. But as the COVID virus claimed the lives of thousands in the state, businesses and nonprofits closed their doors and most North Carolinians stayed home. Peer support was hard to find. The pandemic forced many support groups and mental health services to shift online. After re-emerging into society after years behind bars, some formerly incarcerated people re-entering society don't know the technologies such as cell phones and computers that has been vital to pandemic-era communication. On top of that, people released without IDs or social security numbers were unable to work for weeks after reentering society, Walker said, especially at the height of the pandemic when the Division of Motor Vehicles was shut down. Existing inequities, such as spotty broadband access, were also thrown into high relief during the pandemic, said Philip Cooper, Economic and Workforce Development Director at YMI Cultural Center in Asheville, and a member of the Peer Justice Initiative. And Cooper said, I was recommending to people, don't go back to your rural counties right now. Go somewhere else. People leaving jails and prisons were left feeling directionless, and that can be deadly. One study from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill found that formerly incarcerated people were 40 times more likely to die of an overdose in their first 2 weeks after release than someone in the general population. Many formerly incarcerated people say their drug or alcohol use ultimately landed them in jail or prison, said Walker, adding, if individuals don't have some kind of support when they're being released to do something different, then they're going to go back to doing what they know how to do. In North Carolina, some 98% of people currently incarcerated will eventually be released back into society, according to the North Carolina Department of Public Safety. Reentry is still a challenge for many formerly incarcerated people battling both physical and mental illness. Reentering society after a long jail or prison sentence is already an anxiety-inducing experience, Cooper said. Those doing so worry about where they will live and find work. Further, they aren't linked to the substance use treatment or mental health services that so many justice-involved people need. In 2017, DPS found that 71% of inmates screened for substance use disorder needed long-term treatment. At that time, 17% of the prison population had a mental health diagnosis. Many had more than one. Cooper said, a lot of times these guys don't even properly get engaged for substance use and mental health treatment. He said that formerly incarcerated people also don't trust the counselor or social worker they're connected with because they view that person as working for the system. And they already got this distrust with the system, he said. By the time they come home, the combined anxiety and unstable plans could lead them to self-medicate with drugs or alcohol. Incarceration may be where someone first starts using substances, said Earl Owens, a peer support specialist in Mecklenburg County and a member of the Peer Justice Initiative. He said, I know it's hard for people to believe, but sometimes people go to prison and create a drug habit, one that they didn't have before they were incarcerated. He calls substance use and mental health issues collateral consequences of incarceration. In addition to mental health problems and substance use disorders, people in prison have higher rates of chronic disease like diabetes and hypertension, and communicable diseases like hepatitis C and HIV, according to the American Academy of Family Physicians. In an attempt to combat recidivism rates and ease prisoners' transition back into society, Governor Roy Cooper established the state's Reentry Action Plan in 2018. He said at the time, North Carolina is a better and safer place when those who take responsibility for and learn from their mistakes can get another chance to live productive, purposeful lives. We owe it to everyone to make sure they're successful. The plan established state reentry council collaborative work groups, which include stakeholders statewide, such as businesses, faith-based agencies, and representatives of state agencies. The plan also encouraged local reentry councils and formal partnerships with community organizations doing the work on the ground. The Guilford County Reentry Council is one of those local groups. While the program has been around for years, it opened its physical reentry center in June. Edward Chap Williams, reentry director at that center, said it gives people the ability to change their narrative, their story. He said as he peered at the Wall of Fame at the center during an open house in June. Williams said that formerly incarcerated people can, with the help of reentry programs, fight the narratives in their heads, such as, you'll never be anything, or you'll be just like your mom or dad. He added, now they have some substantial things, some information. They have a job. They're able to pay their rent. Their self-esteem has increased, and for me, that's one of the biggest to see a man or a woman feel like a man or a woman. Co-director K.J. Pau said she has seen how incarceration can be a generational thing through her experience as a detention officer. Children of incarcerated parents are 6 times more likely to also become incarcerated, according to one study by Temple University. She says, I got to see firsthand the revolving door of how people will come in and out constantly because they didn't know. They didn't have the skills. Nobody ever told them there's something different. Many returning citizens also need a medical reentry plan, whether for physical conditions, drug addiction, or mental illness. Although prison offers health care access, many formerly incarcerated lack their own insurance or don't qualify for Medicaid at release. Some 80% of formerly incarcerated people re-enter society without health insurance, according to Health Affairs. Evan Ashkin, the director of the North Carolina Formerly Incarcerated Transition Program, NCFIT, said he initially made the, quote, incorrect assumptions that prisoners would be linked to medical care upon release. He's also professor at the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine and says, even if you didn't care about the person from a fiscal standpoint, diabetes, hypertension, you're going to wind up in an emergency room with terrible complications. However, that is exactly the case. In order to prevent formerly incarcerated people from going without necessary medicine upon their release, which could lead to worsening illness, NCFIT's community health workers, who have a lived experience of incarceration, connect them with health resources at their release. NCFIT is a partnership among UNC Family Medicine, the North Carolina Department of Public Safety, the North Carolina Community Health Center Association, federally qualified health centers, county departments of public health, and community-based reentry programs and councils. Now, this program has sites in Durham, Orange, Wake, Mecklenburg, and Guilford counties, according to his website, but Ashkin said, quote, it still cannot even come close to meeting the need. Ashkin estimated that about 80% of people who participate in NCFIT are uninsured and uninsurable. Because North Carolina has yet to expand Medicaid, people who earn more than about $6,400 and less than $14,500 a year fall into that Medicaid coverage gap and are ineligible for either Medicaid or Affordable Care Act subsidiaries. NCFIT is able to fundraise to get its clients into primary care, but it lacks the funds to get those with serious medical conditions into specialty care. Ashkin said Medicaid expansion would be enormously impactful to the quality of their lives, to them getting the appropriate medical care that anybody else is entitled to who has chronic disease and for prevention. Because of the pandemic, the prison system issued early release for some of its medically vulnerable population to stay with family or in a transition home and be at less risk of contracting COVID-19. But Ashkin pointed out a related problem. These medically vulnerable people lacked access to care. He said, I know there's no connections to health care. How are they getting their meds? Follow up? Everything is closed. NCFIT's solution was FIT Connect, a program that obtained the early release population's medical records to connect them using a network of agencies to appointments at a federally qualified health center in the state. Ashkin said, it's been tricky. It's hard to track down people, and we certainly haven't been 100% successful. We have gotten hundreds of people appointments, so that's good. But paying for it, it's very challenging. All right, Rebecca Schneid from Durham, Beyond Policing. A new department seeks to reimagine how responders in Durham address nonviolent 9/11 calls. Durham's police force has a less contentious relationship with the city's residents than others in the Triangle do, but last summer still saw a strong Black Lives Matter protest presence that precipitated reflection from government officials. the creation of the new Durham Community Safety Department that City Manager Wanda Page announced last May is one example of the tangible outcomes of this reflection. Put simply, the Durham Community Safety Department will work to respond to crises and 9/11 calls without law enforcement officers, and instead with mental health professionals and social workers. The department is still in its fledgling stages and still mostly unstaffed, but Ryan Smith, its new director, who previously led the city of Durham's innovation team, says he has high expectations for the department and that it's symbolic for Durham's future in community-led criminal justice efforts. He says, "The ways that I have approached problem-solving are highly collaborative, people-centered, equity-oriented, data-driven, and trauma-informed." Whew, that's five hyphens in one sentence. "I want to bring those values to this department and to bring people together." In 2019, Durham Beyond Policing, a coalition of Durham nonprofits dedicated to divesting from policing and prisons, lobbied for a city-county Durham Public Schools Joint Community Safety and Wellness Task Force. The city voted yes, but the county and the Durham School Board did not support the effort as readily. Then COVID hit, and last June saw a resurgence of police protests across the Triangle and the nation. Mayor Steve Shule says, "It took the county a bit longer to get on board, but after last year's resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement, there was a lot more interest in this work, and so we established the task force and negotiated the terms for it." The task force was officially announced last December and is composed of two co-chairs, Marsha Owens and Xavier Kaysen, and 15 other members from all three governing bodies. Kaysen previously served on the DPS board and as director of community schools and school transformation for the DPS Foundation and helped write the task force bylaws. Owens served as executive director for the Religious Coalition for a Nonviolent Durham and founder of Restorative Justice Durham. The task force is split into four roundtable discussion groups: school resource officers, criminal legal system, that's courts and incarceration, violence interruption and de-escalation, and 9/11 responses and crisis intervention. Kaysen says, "This is a place for us to come together and ask what if questions. That's very, very rare to have the space to do that and be inventive." Owens and Kaysen say these first months have been about building community among those within the task force. Without closeness, understanding, and clear guidelines, the members say they will be unable to reach clear recommendations for community-based prevention and intervention programs. Kaysen says, "Owens and I are really focused on making sure that everyone involved in this task force digs down to the root of the harm and gets the stories of those who have been harmed." The task force is also utilizing information from a research project the city conducted with RTI last August. The project did an in-depth analysis of 9/11 calls between 2017 and 2020 and identified a number of call types that could be responded to without an armed officer, including mental or behavioral health needs, traffic incidents, and quality of life issues. Shule asks, "Which calls can we respond to with someone who does not have a gun and a badge? Where can you have a mental health worker come, or traffic stops not made by police so as not lead to unnecessary confrontation?" The department will consider the task force recommendations once they're submitted. According to Smith, the department will begin with 15 positions, five of which are pulled from five vacant police department positions. The Durham City Council has also frozen 15 vacant positions in the police department that, after later evaluation, may be transferred to the department if they're needed. These staff members, once hired, will split into positions, working on the department's three main priorities this year. First, the department will pilot multiple alternative response models by trained civilian responders to a subset of 9/11 calls focused on sending the right response to specific community needs. Second, some staff will work directly with the community task force and utilize their recommendations. Third, some staff will provide oversight to the department's contracts and investments, including Bull Cities United's Violence Interrupter Program, in which the city has invested $930,000. Smith said, "Knowing that we have a lot of people who are going to be thinking creatively about this work and engaging deeply with our community, that gives me added reason for confidence that we'll be able to do something good." He says the department is looking at programs across the country for guidance, including Eugene, Oregon's CAHOOTS program and Denver's STAR program, both of which also used community-based models of intervention to address quality of life issues within the cities. He says Denver program, regarded as a success, is one of the best examples for Durham to look at and emulate. After 6 months of the STAR program, the team responded to 748 calls, none of which required assistance from police nor ended in an arrest. Durham will start small, likely with a kind of mobile crisis response team that includes a team of skilled professionals, like Denver did. Since Durham's initial resources and personnel will only support small pilots, learning from and analyzing these analogous programs around the country is a top priority. Smith said it's very promising, and it's an example of what we are really committed to do. There are naysayers out there, though. Some fear that diverting positions away from police, though it is only 1% of staff, might exacerbate Durham's gun violence. Smith, Shewell, and other city officials want to set the record straight on some misconceptions. For one, employees of the Community Safety Department will not respond to violent crime, only to very specific quality of life related calls such as homelessness, addiction, mental health struggles, and the like. Shewell says that police officers he has spoken to are in favor of the task force and the alternative responses, and that they say they think the program will make the city safer. He continues, "I've ridden with police many times, and most of the things they respond to are not related to gun violence or violent crime. Every time one of those calls comes in, it takes time away from the job that they want to do, that they're trained to do, and that we want them to do, which is to solve crime and protect the community from violence." Smith emphasizes that these pilots have not begun yet because the sensitive nature of community safety requires sensitive care. He has high hopes, but realistic goals, he says, and the department will check back in with the city in 6 months. With time, he thinks the program can expand to include co-responses with police and other more expansive practices. And he says, "I feel pressure in the very best way. This is important work that is work that we need to deliver on. I feel full support from city leadership to take the time that we need to plan, and to do it all with a real sense of purpose." All right, now to Orange County and Sarah Pequeno's column, Off to the Races. Policy nerds are quick to point out that every year is an election year. This may not be true for all municipalities in 2021. Raleigh's elections are pushed back to next year, but Orange County is keeping its election date of November the 2nd. 2021 voters will select the Chapel Hill and Carrboro mayors, as well as multiple positions on the Chapel Hill Town Council, Carrboro Town Council, and Chapel Hill Carrboro Board of Education. Hillsborough and Mebane also have positions up for grabs. Only Hillsborough Mayor Jen Weaver is running unopposed this year. leaving a mix of seasoned local politicians and relative newcomers to duke it out on democracy's smallest stage. Some may surprise you, others may not. One surprise in Orange County elections was Lydia Lavelle's decision not to run for re-election as mayor of Carrboro. Lavelle, who works at the NC Central University School of Law, has been in the town's top position since 2013. In Chapel Hill, Councilmember Alan Buonsi also won't run again after his first term. Buonsi, who recently welcomed twins, told the Indy that his decision stemmed from the time commitment it takes to run a campaign, which would pair poorly with caring for two newborns. On the other hand, the three candidates up for re-election in Carrboro, Barbara Fushi, Jacqueline Gist, and Randy Haven O'Donnell, are gunning to stay in their seats. Fushi, the only black person on council, said to Indy, "I'm running to keep a seat at the table. My husband told me when I ran in 2017, Barbara, you have to be at the table. When votes are taken, policies discussed, decisions are made, conversations. Your voice and your face have to be in that room to have impact." In Chapel Hill, Pam Heminger has announced a bid for her fourth term as mayor. Karen Stegman, a Chapel Hill native, also seeks to keep her seat on the town council to continue some of the initiatives around affordable housing and racial justice she and Buonsi spearheaded together. When Lavelle announced she won't be running again, Councilmember Damon Seals said he took some time to evaluate his interest in the gig and decided to throw his hat into the ring. He told the Indy, "Carrboro is a small town, and I want to make sure we're continuing to punch above our weight." He talked about Carrboro's reputation as a progressive leader in the state. You may also recognize another name in the race for Chapel Hill mayor. Hongbin Gu, a council member up for re-election this year, announced that she would challenge Heminger for the position. Gu has received support from Nancy Oates, a former council member who was listed as the editor of the local reporter until recently. New challengers with histories of activism are also looking to shake up the Chapel Hill Town Council. Paris Miller Fouché, the secretary of the Chapel Hill Carrboro NAACP and board member at Empowerment Incorporated, wants to keep affordable housing in the discussion. Miller Fouché said, "I grew up in affordable housing in Durham. It's not peripheral for me to live in public housing and know what that means and the importance of the investment of our community." Another newcomer with a storied presence in town is Vimala Rajendran, the owner of Vimala's Curry Blossom Cafe, who wants to look out for the interests of small business. Rajendran says, "President Biden said in a conversation with me before he was elected that small business is the heartbeat of America. For 11 years, I have been a leader in the industry and nationally recognized for worker justice, and I want that to be the focus of all small businesses and for small businesses to be the focus of Chapel Hill." There are four seats open in Chapel Hill since the vacancy left by former council member Rachel Shavitz has stayed open until now. The other newcomers running are Robert Beasley, Camille Berry, Andrew Creech, Jeffrey Hoagland, and Adam Searing. In Carrboro, two challengers are running against incumbents up for re-election. Danny Noel, a Democratic Socialist who settled in Carrboro to raise his family, told Indy that he seeks to make housing more affordable for Carrboro residents through public-owned housing instead of relying solely on private ventures. Aja Kelleher, a mother and self-described activist, is the other challenger. Two candidates for mayor, Mike Benson in Carrboro and Zachary Boyce in Chapel Hill, decided to run to keep the races from being uncontested, pressuring Heminger, Gu, and Seals to come to events and speak on tough issues. Boyce, a UNC Chapel Hill law student, says he decided to run when he realized there were no black people and no one under 40 running, and that Heminger could potentially run opposed again. And he says, "I would like more graduate and undergraduate students to be involved in local government, because in a place like this, that is a university town, we make knowledge here. We make new ideas here. And who is going to be more committed to putting the new knowledge on the policy table than the people who are making it?" aside from local elections. An empty seat is about to pop up on the Orange County Board of Commissioners at the end of July, when Commissioner Mark DeRosen moves to Florida for a law school teaching position. The board will appoint a new commissioner from a pool of candidates, and the deadline has already passed to submit an application. All right, Jasmine Gallup writes news from Chapel Hill called Go Time. Students at UNC Chapel Hill say the university needs to make good now on its promises of equity and safety to its community members of color. The weekend before last, two men walked onto the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill's campus, waved Confederate flags around a memorial to the school's black founders, and spewed racist slurs at the black students who had gathered around them. For rising junior Jara Fay, the sight was horrifying. She's president-elect of the school's NAACP branch, which will be reactivated this fall, and told the Indy, "Seeing white supremacists come to our campus and spew such hatred was disturbing and sickening. I felt extremely nauseous and overall just physically ill watching that." This isn't the first time white supremacists have visited campus. In the past 5 years, UNC Chapel Hill has been plagued by a string of racist scandals, most notably the controversy over Silent Sam, an 8-foot-tall statue of a Confederate soldier. In 2018 and 19, protests by students and anti-protests by pro-Confederate activists turned the campus into a battleground. At one point, the unsung founders' memorial was vandalized with racist graffiti. Earlier this year, the Campus Y, a building that has long been the center of social justice work at the university, was also vandalized with racist messages. And most recently, that denial of tenure to acclaimed black journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones has reanimated a larger fight by black students for a racial reckoning at UNC Chapel Hill. Last week, black students released a list of demands to make the school safer and more equitable for students of color. "We want to be safe," Fay says. "We want to go to this university and know that somewhere in some department we have a safe space." The university may promote diversity, but the reality is far from what is pictured on recruitment flyers, says Talyaja Teddy Van, president of the Black Student Movement. For years, black students have been profiled by police, assumed to be up to no good, and generally made to feel unwelcome, Van says. Quote, "I don't feel valued. I don't feel loved. I don't feel like people on this campus want me to be here. Oftentimes, racism is a reality our university enables." For Van, even something as simple as walking to class can feel like crossing enemy territory. She says, "It's a microaggression for you to use the physical space you're taking up to force me to move around you, when I'm already having to move around you every single freaking day that I'm at this campus, because the campus was designed and built for you by my enslaved ancestors." Fay agrees, saying she wanted to attend UNC Chapel Hill since third grade, but entering the school as a freshman was disillusioning. And she says, "Naively, I was like, they're going to love me, they're going to accept me, because every pamphlet, they're always putting black and brown faces on them. To get here and find out that I'm only one part of 8% of black students that attend this school was very disheartening." Fay, Van, and many other black students want the university to finally live up to the promises it has made year after year to people of color. For Fay, that means dismantling the entire UNC governing body and rebuilding it in, quote, true democratic form. It's time for UNC to face the music. It's been too many I hear yous and working on it, and we're going to get to it. Fay says, no, it's time. Van says she hopes this will be a critical moment of change for the university. At the same time, however, the campus culture is driving dozens of students and staff to question whether they should stay at the school. Some are choosing to go elsewhere, including to historically black colleges and universities. At many predominantly white institutions, black academics are undervalued. At the same time, they're called upon to be representatives of diversity. Such is the case for UNC Chapel Hill alumna and staff member J.C. Field, who also serves on the college's Diversity and Inclusion Awards Committee, feels as it is emotionally draining to be the only one in the room, to be the only one at the table, to be the only voice in meetings over and over and over. I so rarely see myself represented in the room. It's taxing. One of the benefits of attending or working at a historically black college, like NC Central University in Durham, is a strong sense of having a black community, says Ralph Barrett, chair of the Faculty Senate at NC Central University. As an African-American student at a predominantly white school, the University of Pennsylvania, Barrett says, you always felt as if you were seen differently. You were treated a little bit differently. That's something you're not going to have at Central or any other HBCU. You're not going to get that sense of discrimination. You're not going to get the tyranny of low expectations. Some attribute UNC Chapel Hill's lack of progress to its leadership. The most influential decision makers, the current UNC System Board of Governors and the University Board of Trustees, are appointed by the Republican-led state legislature. Their conservative track records don't create much hope for students or staff that there will soon be a culture shift at the college. In Hannah Jones' case, the decisions made by the board ultimately led her to take a position at Howard University, a historically black research university in Washington, D.C. Van says she was elated that Hannah Jones chose a college that is, quote, proudly established for black people. Hannah Jones' decision is a reminder to black students and staff that they don't have to take the path that white-dominated systems outline for them. And Van says, oftentimes the powers that be will say, pick a lane, lane A or lane B. But ultimately, we all have the power to step out of those lanes and say, I'm going to create a third option. UNC Chapel Hill doesn't get to decide Hannah Jones' worth and value. She ultimately gets to decide it for herself. Tangential to that article is a small article by Jasmine Gallup. UNC Chapel Hill could face an investigation from its accrediting agency. They may be at risk of losing its accreditation after recent accusations of racism and corruption. When the denial of tenure to Nicole Hannah-Jones gained national attention, staff at the accrediting agency, the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges, started, quote, monitoring the situation, says Nuria Cuevas, the vice president of that organization. The information brought to light by news media was enough to trigger an inquiry, where staff requested certain information from the university. Cuevas says, we haven't received the information yet from them, so it's hard to know at this point whether it could affect accreditation. Once we receive it, she says, if we find there's factual accreditation-related information, we forward it on to our board for our review. Accreditation is the process through which universities become eligible for federal funding. It also sets a standard for higher education. In addition to educational requirements, UNC Chapel Hill is required to operate with integrity and demonstrate a dedication to continuous improvement. It must also have a governing board not excessively influenced by others, including lawmakers, donors, or prominent alumni, employ qualified faculty, preserve academic freedom, and provide resources to support student success. Cuevas declined to comment on the specific accreditation standards the association is evaluating at Chapel Hill. From the time an inquiry begins, it typically takes 6 to 8 weeks to make a decision about whether to continue investigating. Reports of racial bias and lack of diversity among faculty and staff have put universities at risk of losing accreditation in the past. Last week, the Tulane University School of Medicine was put on probation after a black faculty member filed a lawsuit alleging discrimination. Similarly, UNC Chapel Hill could come under that microscope because of its lack of diversity or allegations of racism from students and staff. SACSCOC doesn't have a specific accreditation requirement related to diversity, says Cuevas, but it does have a position statement that acts as a kind of guiding principle for universities and colleges. Cuevas says our primary concern, really, is institutional quality and student success. That's always foremost, is the well-being of students, the educational program, and the educational experience. All right, here's a quickie article by Debbie Matthews about the Triangles ice cream scene. And I will excerpt some of this as I get near the end. When I was asked to do a deep dive into the Triangles ice cream scene, it was like Christmas in July. Who wouldn't want to figuratively bathe in oceans of frozen treats when it's 90 degrees outside? Oh, jokes were made. Taking one for the team, I might have said, or it's a tough job. But inside, believe me, I was screaming for ice cream. Is there, you might ask, a need for yet another ice cream directory? Well, every summer the Triangle's inventive ice cream scene evolves just a little bit, whether by a new shop, scoop, or flavor. To keep pace, accompanied by a good friend and my 20-something child, I embarked on a trek through the Triangle, thoroughly examining 9 local independent purveyors of frozen treats. We were thrilled to discover that each location did something, sometimes more than one something, better than anybody. Now, as we know, the Indies readers voted best of picks for ice cream and everything else dropped last week. But this week we're pleased to give you a further scoop on the many ice cream dreams our area has to offer. And so these are her categories, and I'll just give a brief synopsis of the little paragraph about each of them. Best working dairy and ice cream stand, Mapleview Farm in Rocky Ridge Road in Hillsboro. That drive through the countryside reminds us of Sunday drives of our childhood, and the reward is a house on the rise that exists solely to serve up ice cream treats. Best ice cream worth the brain freeze is Broken Spoke Farm on St. Mary's Road out in Hillsboro. This farm looks like something between a Monet painting and something from an Edgar Allan Poe farm. They have other foods, a cooler full of cheeses and a farm stand. They make soft-serve ice cream from their own recipes. No easy feat. Best place in Chapel Hill to take visitors for frosty treats, the Yogurt Pump. That's on the heart of Franklin Street. Known locally as Yopo. It's the only frozen yogurt joint on this list. Most original ice cream eatery with a dash of humor. Simon Says Dip This. Nathan and Audrey Simons. They're on West Paris Street. They're known as local farmers markets for silky, delicious nut butters. We have most unusual delivery device and the best way to eat your purple sweet potatoes. Sugar Koi, that's on West Main Street. This Bright Leaf Square ice creamery serves a combination of purchased and house-made flavors. The Sugar Koi-made treats are inspired by owner Nat Jira's time growing up in Thailand and include brightly colored varieties like Thai tea, matcha, and ubi, which are purple sweet potatoes from the Philippines. Best Bull City ice cream place to impress visitors is the Parlor that started as a food truck in Durham, and now it's at CCB Plaza. Best ice cream flavors you didn't even know existed, La Vida Dulce on East Chatham Street in Cary. Tucked into a strip mall is a museum of sweet and savory Mexican street foods. We began our tour with elote cups, Dixie cups full of corn, chili lime seasoning, and topped with mounds of cotija cheese. Then the ice cream. Pine nut. Who knew? The Barbie pink ice cream is studded with toasted piñones, which are somehow both creamy and crunchy. Ice cream that most tastes like it was churned on grandma's back porch is various locations, local ice cream, made of local milk from free-range cows. Ice cream of every flavor is creamy and fresh-tasting. The company's name is Fresh. The big story is their Madagascar vanilla ice cream. It tastes like vanilla did when you were a child and weren't aware yet that vanilla can often be used as a synonym for boring. It tastes like grandma churned it. And the best ice cream place in Raleigh to take out-of-towners, plus the topping we wish we'd been eating on everything our entire lives. Howling Cow Dairy Education and Creamery, there on Dairy Lane in Raleigh. That's on North Carolina State's visually stunning dairy farm, the Howling Cow. This ice creamery does not apologize for being a celebration of cows. Their graham cracker ice cream is unique and delicious, and unique and crazy delicious. The fluffy sugar sundae is made with a revelatory lemon ice cream and topped with marshmallow cream, which is pretty great, but then they torch it. Torch it! And we'll end here, so you may contemplate that. Well, I will have no more time to discuss anything officially best of the triangle, but here's a stage article by Brian Woods about the Fringe, WT Fringe Festival. And that's coming right up. It begins on July the 23rd with the first theatrical production, all online. If the producers have done their work well, a Fringe Festival should be almost impossible to categorize. A collection of shows situated often simultaneously on one or more edges, from artistic and cultural to the technological. Fringe work lies along and usually pushes us beyond previously established borders. Now, this year's National Women's Theater Festival's WTF Fringe 21 Festival, all 14 productions in this year's complement are virtual, a combination of live and pre-recorded feeds aggregated from locations across the nations and the globe and put online through the festival's Nexus in Raleigh. There are five productions already scheduled for the festival's last weekend, and the two top candidates for the juried Best of Fringe showcase on Sunday, July 25, stretch audiences from earnest consideration of racial schisms to caustic social satire, and from innovative genre fusions of music and dance to an immersive and truly sublime virtual reality experience. And here are the three coming up. July the 23rd, Theater, A Love Story. July the 24th, No Justice, When Once the Sky Was Blue. And July 25th, The Best of Fringe, Electra and Terms of Forbearance. So I'm sorry I can't give any more of that, but their web address, Women's Theater Festival, Women's, Theatre, Women's Theater Festival, .com. Check that out. It's all online. All right. Creeping into our studio. Boilerplate themes bring our riveting opening and closing music to remind me that it's time to be quiet and go away. A sentiment that could be echoed by many of our listeners. But in any event, this is John Federson with the current issue of Indie Week. And for those of you hungry to hear that all over again, you can go to our website, ncreadingservice.org, and look at the podcast section where you will find The Independent listed. And if you don't want to, but you want to hear next week, come back again and hear John Federson again with our weekly journal, The Indie Week, from ncreadingservice.com.